The Bear and the Dragon by Tom Clancy, Part 2. This part consists of chapters 24 through 45. Chapter 24. Infanticide.
"What's this?" the President asked at his morning intelligence briefing.
"A new Sorgosaurus. This one's called Warbler. I'm afraid it's not as good from an intelligence point of view, though it does tell us things about their ministers," Dr. Goodley added with some feigned delicacy. "Whoever Warbler was, Ryan saw, it was definitely a she, kept a very intimate diary. She too worked with this minister, Fangan, and it appeared he was enamored of her, and she, if not exactly enamored of him, certainly kept records of his activities. All of them, Ryan saw. It was enough to make his eyes go a little wide this early in the morning.
Tell Mary Pat that she can sell this stuff to Hustler if she wants, but I really don't need it at 8 in the goddamn morning.
She included it to give you a feel for the source," Ben explained. "The material isn't as narrowly political as we're getting from Songbird, but MP thinks it tells us a lot about the guy's character, which is useful. And also there's some political content to go along with the information on Fang's sex life. It would appear he's a man of, commendable vigor, I guess, although the girl in question would clearly prefer a younger lover. It appears that she had one, but this Fang guy scared him off."
"Possessive bastard," Ryan saw, skimming that section.
"Well, I guess at that age you hold on to what you need. Does this tell us anything?"
"Sir, it tells us something about the kind of people who make decisions over there. Here we call them sexual predators,
of which we have a few in government service ourselves," Ryan observed. The papers had just broken a story on a member of the Senate.
"At least not in this office," Goodley told his president. He didn't add, "any more."
"Well, this president is married to a surgeon. She knows how to use sharp instruments," Ryan said with a wry grin.
"So the Taiwan stuff yesterday was just a ploy because they haven't figured out how to address the trade issues yet?"
"So it would appear, and yes, that does seem a little odd. Also, MP thinks that they might have a low-level source in state. They know a little more than they could have gotten from the press, she thinks."
"Oh, great," Jack noted. "So what happened? The Japanese corporation sold their old sources to the Chinese?"
Goodley shrugged.
"No telling at this time.
Have Mary Pat call Dan Murray about this. Counterespionage is the FBI's department. Is this something we want to move on at once, or will this compromise Songbird?"
"That's for somebody else to judge, sir," Goodley said, reminding the president that he was good, but not quite that good at this business.
"Yeah, somebody other than me, too.
What else?"
"The Senate Select Intelligence Committee wants to look into the Russian situation."
"That's nice. What's the beef?"
"They seem to have their doubts about how trustworthy our friends in Moscow are. They're worried that they're going to use the oil and gold money to become the USSR again, and maybe threaten NATO."
"NATO's moved a few hundred miles east last time I looked. The buffer zone will not hurt our interests."
"Except that we are obligated to defend Poland now," Goodley reminded his boss.
"I remember. So tell the Senate to authorize funds to move a tank brigade east of Warsaw. We can take over one of the old Soviet lagers, can't we?"
"If the Poles want us to."
"They don't seem overly concerned, sir."
"Probably more worried by the Germans, right?"
"Correct, and there is a precedent for that concern."
"When will Europe get the word that peace is finally broken up for good and all?" Ryan asked the ceiling.
"Well, there's a lot of history, some of it pretty recent, for them to remember, Mr. President. And much of it militates in the other direction."
"I've got a trip to Poland scheduled, don't I?"
"Yes, not too far off, and they're working out the itinerary right now." Okay, I'll tell the Polish president personally that he can depend on us to keep the Germans under control. If they step out of line, well, we'll take Chrysler back. Jack sipped his coffee and checked his watch. Anything else? That should do it for today. The president looked up slyly. Tell Mary Pat if she sends me more of this warbler stuff. I want the pictures to go with it.
Will do, sir.
Goodley had himself a good hoot at that. Ryan picked up the briefing papers again and read through them more slowly this time, between sips of coffee and snorts, with a few grumbles thrown in. Life had been much easier when he was the guy who prepared these briefing papers than it was now that he was the guy who had to read them. Why was that? Shouldn't it have been the other way around? Before, he'd been the one to find the answers and anticipate the questions. But now that other people had done all that stuff for him, it was harder. That didn't make any sense at all, damn it. Maybe, he decided, it was because, after him, the information stopped. He had to make the decisions. And so whatever other decisions and analyses had been made at lower levels, the process came to one place and stopped cold. It was like driving a car. Someone else could tell him to turn right at the corner, but he was the guy at the wheel who had to execute the turn, and if somebody clobbered the car, he was the guy who'd get the blame. For a moment, Jack wondered if he was better suited to being a step or two down in the process, able to do the analysis work and make his recommendations with confidence, but always knowing that someone else would always get the credit for making the right move, or the blame for making the wrong one. In that insulation from consequence, there was safety and security. But that was cowardice talking, Ryan reminded himself. If there were anyone in Washington better suited for making decisions, he hadn't met the guy yet, and if that was arrogance talking, then so be it. But there ought to be someone better, Jack thought, as the clock wound to his first appointment of the day. And it wasn't his fault that there wasn't. He checked his appointment sheet. The whole day was political bullshit. Except it wasn't bullshit. Everything he did in this office affected the lives of American citizens in one way or another, and that made it important, to them and to him. But who had decided to make him the national daddy? What the hell made him so damn smart? The people behind his back, as he thought of it, outside the overly thick windows of the Oval Office, all expected him to know how to do the right thing. And over the dinner table, or a low-stakes card game, they'd bitch and moan and complain about the decisions he'd made that they didn't like, as though they knew better. Which was easy to say out there. In here it was different. And so Ryan had to apply himself to every little decision, even menus for school lunches. That one was a real son of a bitch. If you gave kids what they liked to eat, nutritionists would complain that they really ought to eat healthy twigs and berries. But for the most part, parents would probably opt for burgers and fries, because that's what the kids would eat, and even healthy food, uneaten, did them little good. He talked that one over with Kathy once or twice, but he really didn't need to. She let their own kids eat pizza whenever they wished, claiming that pizza was high in protein, and that a kid's metabolism could eat almost anything without ill effect. But when cornered, she'd admit that put her at odds with some of her fellow professors at Johns Hopkins. And so what was Jack Ryan, President of the United States, Doctor of Philosophy and History, Bachelor of Arts and Economics, and a certified public accountant? Ryan couldn't even remember why he had bothered taking that exam, supposed to think, when experts, including the one he was married to, disagreed. That was worth another snort, when his desk buzzer went off and Mrs. Sumter announced that his first appointment of the day was here. Already Jack was wishing for a bummed cigarette, but he couldn't do that until he had a break in his schedule, because only Mrs. Sumter and a few of his Secret Service detail were allowed to know that the President of the United States suffered intermittently from that vice. Jesus, he thought. as he did so often when the workday began. How did I ever get stuck in here? Then he stood and faced the door, conjuring up his welcoming presidential smile, as he tried to remember who the hell was coming in first to discuss farm subsidies in South Dakota. The flight, as usual, was out of Heathrow, this one in a Boeing 737, because it wasn't all that long a hop to Moscow. The Rainbow Troopers filled the entire first-class section, which would please the cabin staff, though they didn't know it yet, because the passengers would be unusually polite and undemanding. Chavez sat with his father-in-law, politely watching the safety briefing video, though both knew that if the airplane hit the ground at 400 knots, it really wouldn't help all that much to know where the nearest emergency exit was. But such things were rare enough to be ignored. Ding grabbed the magazine from the pocket in front and flipped through it in the hope of finding something interesting. He'd already bought all the useful items from the Flying Mall magazine, some to his wife's pitying amusement. "So, the little guy's walking better?" Clark asked.
"You know, the enthusiasm he has for it is kind of funny, the big grin every time he makes it from the TV to the coffee table. Like he's won the marathon, got a big gold medal, and a kiss from Miss America on his way to Disney World."
"The big things are made up of a lot of little things, Domingo," Clark observed, as the aircraft started its takeoff run. "And the horizon's a lot closer when you're that short."
"I suppose, Mr. C. Does seem kind of amusing, though.
And kind of cute," he allowed.
"Not bad duty being the father of a little guy, is it?"
"I got no complaints," Chavez agreed, leaning his seat back now that the gear was up. "How's Atori working out?"
"Back to business," Clark decided. "This grandpa stuff had its limitations."
"He's in better shape now. Needed about a month to get caught up. He took some razzing, but he handled it just fine. You know he's smart. Good tactical instincts, considering he's a cop and not a soldier."
"Being a cop in Sicily isn't like walking a beat on Oxford Street in London, you know."
"Yeah, guess so," Chavez agreed. "But on the simulator, he hasn't made a single shoot, no-shoot mistake yet, and that's not bad. The only other guy who hasn't blown one is Eddie Price. The computerized training simulator back at Hereford was particularly ruthless in its presentation of possible tactical scenarios, to the point that in one, a 12-year-old picked up an AK-47 and hosed you if you didn't pay close enough attention. The other nasty one was the woman holding the baby, who just happened to pick up a pistol from a dead terrorist and turn innocently to face the incoming men of black. Ding had taken her down once, to find a Cabbage Patch doll on his desk the next morning with a packet of McDonald's ketchup spread across the face. The Rainbow Troopers had a lively, if somewhat perverse, institutional sense of humor.
"So, what exactly are we supposed to be doing?"
"The old 8th Chief Directorate of the KGB, their Executive Protective Service," John explained. "They've got worries about domestic terrorists. From the Chechens, I guess, and other internal nationalities who want out of the country. They want us to help train up their boys to deal with them."
"How good are they?" Ding asked.
Rainbow Six shrugged.
"Good question. The personnel are former KGB types, but with Spetsnaz training. So probably career people as opposed to 2-year in-and-outs in the Red Army. All probably titular commissioned officers, but with sergeant's duties. I expect they'll be smart, properly motivated, probably in decent physical shape, and they'll understand the mission. Will they be as good as they need to be?
Probably not, John thought.
But in a few weeks we ought to be able to point them in the right direction.
So mainly we're going to be training up their instructors?
Clark nodded.
That's how I read it, yeah.
Fair enough, Chavez agreed, as the lunch menu appeared.
Why was it, he wondered, that airline food never seemed to have what you wanted? This was dinner food, not lunch food. What the hell was wrong with a cheeseburger and fries? Oh, well, at least he could have a decent beer.
The one thing he'd come to love about life in the UK was the beer. There wouldn't be anything like it in Russia, he was sure. Sunrise in Beijing was as drab as the polluted air could make it, Mark Gant thought. For some reason, he'd slipped out of sync with the local time, despite the black capsule and planned sleep. He'd found himself awake just at first light, which fought through air that was as bad as Los Angeles on its worst ever day. Certainly there was no EPA in the PRC, and this place didn't even have much in the way of automobiles yet. If that ever happened, China might solve its local population problem with mass gassing. He hadn't been around enough to recognize this as a problem of Marxist nations. But there weren't many of them left to be examples, were there? Gant had never smoked. It was a vice largely removed from the stock trading community, where the normal working stress was enough of a killer that they needed few others. And this degree of air pollution made his eyes water. He had nothing to do and lots of time in which to do it. Once awake, he was never able to escape back into sleep. So he decided to flip on his reading light and go over some documents, most of which he'd been given without any particular expectation that he would read them. The purpose of diplomacy, Commander Spock had once said on Star Trek, was to prolong a crisis. Certainly the discourse meandered enough to make the Mississippi River look like a laser beam. But like the Father of Waters, it eventually had to get downstream, or downhill, or wherever the hell it was that rivers went. But this morning, what had awakened him? He looked out the window, seeing the orange-pink smudge beginning to form at the horizon, backlighting the buildings. Gant found them ugly, but he knew he just wasn't used to them. The tenements of Chicago weren't exactly the Taj Mahal, and the wood-frame house of his youth wasn't Buckingham Palace. Still, the sense of differentness here was overpowering. Everywhere you looked, things seemed alien, and he wasn't cosmopolitan enough to overcome that feeling. It was like a background buzz in the Muzak, never quite there, but never gone away either. It was almost a sense of foreboding, but he shook it off. There was no reason to feel anything like that. He didn't know that he would be proven wrong very soon. Barry Wise was already up in his hotel room, with breakfast coming. The hotel was one of an American chain, and the breakfast menu approximately American as well. The local bacon would be different, but even Chinese chickens laid real eggs, he was sure. His previous day's experiment with waffles hadn't worked out very well, and Wise was a man who needed a proper breakfast to function throughout the day. Unlike most American TV correspondents/reporters, Wise looked for his own stories. His producer was a partner, not a boss handler. He credited that fact for his collection of Emmy Awards, though his wife just grumbled about dusting the damn things behind the basement bar. He needed a fresh new story for today. His American audience would be bored with another talking head plus B-roll piece on the trade negotiations. He needed some local color, he thought, something to make the American people feel as one with the Chinese people. It wasn't easy, and there'd been enough stories on Chinese restaurants, which was the only Chinese thing with which most Americans were familiar. What then? What did Americans have in common with the citizens of the People's Republic of China? Not a hell of a lot, Wise told himself, but there had to be something he could use. He stood when breakfast arrived, looking out the picture windows as the waiter wheeled the cart close to the bed. It turned out that they'd goofed on his order, ham instead of bacon, but the ham looked okay, and he went with it, tipping the waiter and sitting back down. Something, he thought, pouring his coffee, but what? He'd been through this process often enough. The writers of fiction often chided reporters for their own sort of creativity. But the process was real. Finding stuff of interest was doubly hard for reporters because, unlike novelists, they couldn't make things up. They had to use reality. And reality could be a son of a bitch, Barry Wise thought. He reached for his reading glasses in the drawer of the night table and was surprised to see... Well, it wasn't all that surprising. It was a matter of routine in any American hotel, a Bible left there by the Gideon Society. It was only here probably because the hotel was American-owned and operated, and they had a deal with the Gideon people. But what a strange place to find a Bible. The People's Republic wasn't exactly overrun with churches. Were there Christians here? Why not find out? Maybe there was a story in that. Better than nothing, anyway. With that, Sammy decided he went back to breakfast. His crew would be waking up about now. He'd have his producer look around for a Christian minister, maybe even a Catholic priest. A rabbi was too much to hope for. That would mean the Israeli embassy. And that was cheating, wasn't it? "How was your day, Jack?" Kathy asked. The night was an accident. They had nothing to do, no political dinner, no speech, no reception, no play or concert at the Kennedy Center, not even an intimate party of 20 or 30 on the bedroom level of the residence portion of the White House, which Jack hated and Kathy enjoyed, because they could invite people they actually knew and liked to those, or at least people whom they wanted to meet. Jack didn't mind the parties as such, but he felt that the bedroom level of the house, as the Secret Service called it, as opposed to the other house 16 blocks down the street, was the only private space he had left. Even the place they owned at Peregrine Cliff on Chesapeake Bay had been redone by the service. Now it had fire protection sprinklers, about 70 phone lines, an alarm system like they used to protect nuclear weapon storage sites, and a new building to house the protective detail who deployed there on the weekends when the Ryans decided to see if they still had a house to retreat to when this official museum got to be too much. But tonight there was none of that. Tonight they were almost real people again. The difference was that if Jack wanted a beer or drink, he couldn't just walk to the kitchen and get it. That wasn't allowed. No, he had to order it through one of the White House ushers, who'd either take the elevator down to the basement-level kitchen or to the upstairs bar. He could, of course, have insisted and walked off to make his own, but that would have meant insulting one of the ushers. And while these men, mainly black, some said they traced their lineage back to Andrew Jackson's personal slaves, didn't mind, it seemed unnecessarily insulting to them. Ryan had never been one to have others do his work, however. Oh, sure, it was nice to have his shoes shined every night by some guy who didn't have anything else to do, and who drew a comfortable government salary to do it. But it just seemed unmanly to be fussed over as if he were some sort of nobleman, when in fact his father had been a hard-working homicide detective on the Baltimore City Police Force. And he'd needed a government scholarship, courtesy of the United States Marine Corps, to get through Boston College without having his mom take a job. Was it his working-class roots and upbringing? Probably, Ryan thought. Those roots also explained what he was doing now, sitting in an easy chair with a drink in his hand, watching TV, as though he were a normal person for a change. Kathy's life was actually the least changed in the family, except that every morning she flew to work on a Marine Corps VH-60 Black Hawk helicopter, to which the taxpayers and the media didn't object. Not after Sandbox, also known as Katie Ryan, had been attacked in her daycare center by some terrorists. The kids were off watching televisions of their own, and Kyle Daniel, known to the Secret Service as Sprite, was asleep in his crib. And so that Dr. Ryan, codenamed Surgeon, was sitting in her own chair in front of the TV, going over her patient notes and checking a medical journal as part of her never-ending professional education. "How are things at work, honey?" Swordsman asked Surgeon. "Pretty good, Jack. Bernie Katz has a new granddaughter. He's all bubbly about it."
"Which kid?"
"His son Mark. Got married 2 years ago. We went, remember?" "That's the lawyer?" Jack asked, remembering the ceremony in the good old days, before he'd been cursed into the presidency. "Yeah, his other son David is the doctor, up at Yale on the faculty. Thoracic surgeon. Have I met that one? Jack couldn't remember. No, he went to school out west. UCLA. She turned the page in the current New England Journal of Medicine, then decided to dog-ear it. It was an interesting piece on a new discovery in anesthesia, something worth remembering. She'd talk about it at lunch with one of the professors. It was her custom to lunch with her colleagues in different fields, to keep current on what was going on in medicine. The next big breakthrough, she thought, would be in neurology. One of her Hopkins colleagues had discovered a drug that seemed to make damaged nerve cells regrow. If it panned out, that was a Nobel Prize. It would be the ninth hanging on the trophy wall of the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Her work with surgical lasers had won her a Lasker Public Service Award, the highest such award in American medicine. But it hadn't been fundamental enough for a trip to Stockholm. That was fine with her. Ophthalmology wasn't that sort of field, but fixing people's sight was pretty damned rewarding. Maybe the one good thing about Jack's elevation and her attendant status as First Lady was that she'd have a real shot at the directorship of the Wilmer Institute, if and when Bernie Katz ever decided to hang it up. She'd still be able to practice medicine. That was something she never wanted to give up. And also be able to oversee research in her field, decide who got the grants, where the really important exploratory work was, and that, she thought, was something she might be good at. So maybe this president stuff wasn't a total loss. Her only real beef was that people expected her to dress like a supermodel, and while she had always dressed well, being a clothes horse had never appealed to her. It was enough, she figured, to wear nice formal gowns at all the damned formal affairs she had to attend, and not get charged for it, since the gowns were all donated by the makers. As it was, Women's Wear Daily didn't like her normal choice of clothing, as though her white lab coat was a fashion statement. No, it was her uniform, like the Marines who stood at the doors to the White House, and one she wore with considerable pride. Not many women or men could claim to be at the very pinnacle of their profession. But she could. As it was, this had turned into a nice evening. She didn't even mind Jack's addiction to the History Channel, even when he grumbled at some minor mistake in one of their shows. Assuming, she chuckled to herself, that he was right and the show was wrong. Her wine glass was empty, and since she didn't have any procedures scheduled for the next day, she waved to the usher for a refill. Life could have been worse. Besides, they'd had their big scare with those damned terrorists, and with good luck and that wonderful FBI agent Andrea Price had married, they'd survived, and she didn't expect anything like that to happen again. Her own Secret Service detail was her defense against that. Her own principal agent, Roy Altman, inspired the same sort of confidence at his job that she did at hers, Kathy judged. "Here you go, Dr. Ryan," the usher said, delivering the refilled glass. "Thank you, George. How are the kids?" "My oldest just got accepted to Notre Dame," he answered proudly. "That's wonderful. What's she going to major in?" "Pre-med." Kathy looked up from her journal. "Great. If there's any way I can help her, you let me know, okay?" "Yes, ma'am, I sure will." And the nice thing, George thought, was that she wasn't kidding. The Ryans were very popular with the staff, despite their awkwardness with all the fussing. There was one other family the Ryans looked after, the widow and kids of some Air Force sergeant whose connection with the Ryans nobody seemed to understand. And Kathy had personally taken care of two kids of staff members who'd had eye problems. "What's tomorrow look like, Jack?" "Speech to the VFW convention in Atlantic City. I chop her there and back after lunch. Not a bad speech," Callie wrote for me. "She's a little weird." "She's different," the president agreed, "but she's good at what she does." "Thank God," Kathy didn't say aloud, "that I don't have to do much of that." For her, a speech was telling a patient how she was going to fix his or her eyes. "There's a new papal nuncio in Beijing," the producer said. "That's an ambassador-like, isn't it?" The producer nodded. "Pretty much. Italian guy, Cardinal Renato de Milo. Old guy. Don't know anything about him.
Well, maybe we can drive over and meet the guy, Barry thought as he knotted his tie.
Got an address and phone number?
No, but our contact at the American Embassy can get him quick enough.
Give the guy a call, Wise ordered gently. He and the producer had been together for 11 years, and together they dodged bullets and won those Emmys, which wasn't bad for a couple of ex-Marine sergeants.
Right. Wise checked his watch. The timing worked just fine. He could get a report at his leisure, upload it on the satellite, and Atlanta could edit it and show it to people for breakfast in America. That would pretty much take care of his day in this heathen country.
Damn, why couldn't they do trade conferences in Italy?
He remembered Italian food fondly from his time in the Mediterranean Fleet Marine Force.
And the Italian women. They'd like the United States Marine uniform.
Well, lots of women did.
One thing neither Cardinal DeMilo nor Monsignor Shepka had learned to like was Chinese breakfast food, which was totally alien from anything Europeans had ever served for the early morning meal. And so Shepka fixed breakfast every morning before their Chinese staff came in. They'd do the dishes, which was enough for both churchmen. Both had already said their morning mass, which necessitated their rising before 6 every morning, rather like soldiers did, the elderly Italian had often remarked to himself. The morning paper was the International Herald Tribune, which was too American-oriented, but the world was an imperfect place. At least the paper showed the football scores, and European football was a sport of interest to both of them, and one which Shepka could still go out and play when the opportunity arose. DeMilo, who'd been a pretty good midfielder in his day, had to content himself with watching and kibitzing now. The CNN crew had their own van, an American make that had been shipped into the PRC ages ago. It had its own miniature satellite transceiver rig, a small technical miracle of sorts that enabled instant contact with any place in the world via orbiting communication satellites. It could do anything but operate when the vehicle was moving, and someone was working on that feature, which would be the next major breakthrough, because then the mobile crews could work with little threat of interference from the Gomers in whatever country they happened to be operating. They also had a satellite navigation system, which was a genuine miracle that allowed them to navigate anywhere, in any city for which they had a CD-ROM map. With it, they could find any address faster than a local taxi driver. And with a cell phone, they could get the address itself, in this case from the U.S. Embassy, which had the street addresses for all foreign legations, of which the Papal Nuncio's house was just one more. The cell phone also allowed them to call ahead. The call was answered by a Chinese voice at first, then one that sounded German, of all things, but which said, "Sure, come on over." Barry Wise was dressed in his usual coat and tie. His neatness was another leftover from the Marines, and he knocked on the door, finding the expected local. He was tempted to call them natives, but that was too English and distantly racist, at the door to conduct them in. The first Westerner they met was clearly not a cardinal, too young, too tall, and far too German.
"Hello, I am Monsignor Shepka," the man greeted him.
"Good day, I am Barry Wise of CNN."
"Yes," Shepka acknowledged with a smile. "I have seen you many times on the television. What brings you here?"
"We're here to cover the trade meeting between America and China, but we decided to look for other items of interest. We were surprised to see that the Vatican has a diplomatic mission here."
Shepka ushered Wise into his office and motioned him to a comfortable chair.
"I've been here for several months, but the Cardinal just arrived recently."
"Can I meet him?"
"Certainly, but His Eminence is on the phone to Rome at the moment. Do you mind waiting a few minutes?"
"No problem," Wise assured him.
He looked the Monsignor over. He looked athletic, tall, and very German. Wise had visited that country many times, and always felt somewhat uneasy there, as if the racism that had occasioned the Holocaust was still there somewhere, hiding close by but out of sight. In other clothing, he would have taken Shepka for a soldier, even a Marine. He looked physically fit and very smart, clearly a keen observer.
"What order are you in, if I may ask?" Wise said.
"The Society of Jesus," Shepka replied.
A Jesuit, Wise thought at once. That explained it.
"From Germany?"
"Correct, but I'm based in Rome now at Robert Bellarmine University, and I was asked to accompany His Eminence here because of my language skills." His English was about halfway between English and American, but not Canadian, grammatically perfect and remarkably precise in his pronunciations.
"And because you're smart," Wise added to himself.
He knew that the Vatican had a respected intelligence-gathering service, probably the oldest in the world. So this Monsignor was a combination diplomat and spook, Wise decided.
"I won't ask how many languages you speak. I'm sure you have me beat," Wise observed. He'd never met or even heard of a dumb Jesuit.
Shepka offered a friendly smile.
"It is my function."
Then he looked at his desk phone. The light had gone out. Shepka excused himself and headed to the inner office, then returned.
"His Eminence will see you now."
Wise rose and followed the German priest in. The man he saw was corpulent and clearly Italian, dressed not in priestly robes but rather a coat and trousers, with a red shirt, or was it a vest, underneath his Roman collar. The CNN correspondent didn't remember if the protocol was for him to kiss the man's ring, but hand-kissing wasn't his thing anyway, and so he just shook hands in the American custom.
"Welcome to our legation," Cardinal DeMillo said. "You are our first American reporter. Please."
The cardinal gestured him to a chair.
"Thank you, Your Eminence."
Wise did remember that part of the protocol.
"How may we serve you this day?"
"Well, we're in town to cover the trade talks, America and China, and we're just looking for a story about life in Beijing. We just learned last night that the Vatican has an embassy here, and we thought we might come over to talk to you, sir."
"Marvelous," DeMillo observed with a gracious, priestly smile.
"There are a few Christians in Beijing, though this is not exactly Rome."
Wise felt a light bulb go off.
"What about Chinese Christians?"
"We've only met a few. We're going over to see one this afternoon, as a matter of fact, a Baptist minister named Yu."
"Really?"
That was a surprise.
"A local Baptist?"
"Yes," Shepka confirmed. "Good chap. He was even educated in America at Oral Roberts University."
"A Chinese citizen from Oral Roberts?" Wise asked, somewhat incredulously, as the story light flashed in his head.
"Yes, it is somewhat unusual, isn't it?" DeMillo observed.
It was unusual enough that a Baptist and a cardinal of the Roman Catholic Church were on speaking terms, Wise thought. But to have it happen here seemed about as likely as a live dinosaur strolling up the mall in Washington. Atlanta would sure as hell like this one.
"Could we go over with you?" the CNN correspondent asked.
The terror began soon after she arrived at her workplace. For all the waiting and all the anticipation, it still came as a surprise, and an unwelcome one, the first twinge in her lower abdomen. The last time, now nearly 6 years before, it had presaged the birth of Julong, and been a surprise as well. But that pregnancy had been authorized, and this one was not. She'd hoped that it would begin in the morning, but on a weekend in their apartment, where she and Quan could handle things without external complications. But babies came at their own time in China, as they did elsewhere in the world, and this one would be no exception. The question was whether or not the state would allow it to take his first breath. And so the first muscle twinge, the first harbinger of the contractions of frank labor, brought with it the fear that murder would be committed, that her own body would be the scene of the crime, that she would be there to see it, to feel the baby stop moving, to feel death. The fear was the culmination of all the sleepless nights and the nightmares which had caused her to sweat in her bed for weeks. Her co-workers saw her face and wondered. A few of the women on the shop floor had guessed her secret,
though they'd never discussed it with her. The miracle was that no one had informed on her, and that had been Lianhua's greatest fear of all. But that just wasn't the sort of thing one woman could do to another. Some of them, too, had given birth to daughters who had accidentally died a year or two later to satisfy their husband's desire for a male heir. That was one more aspect of life in the People's Republic that was rarely the subject of conversation, even among women in private. And so young Lianhua looked around the factory floor, feeling her muscles announce what was to come. And all she could hope was that it would stop, or delay itself. Another 5 hours, and she could pedal her bicycle home and deliver the baby there. And maybe that wasn't as good as on a weekend, but it was better than having an emergency here. Lotus Flower told herself that she had to be strong and resolute. She closed her eyes, and bit her lip, and tried to concentrate on her job. But the twinges soon grew into discomfort. Then would come mild pain, followed by the real contractions that would deny her the ability to stand, and then what? It was her inability to see just a few hours beyond where she stood that contorted her face worse than pain ever could. She feared death, and while that fear is known to all humans, hers was for a life still part of herself, but not really her own. She feared seeing it die, feeling it die, feeling an unborn soul depart. And while it would surely go back to God, that was not God's intention. She needed her spiritual counselor now. She needed her husband, Quan. She needed Reverend Yu even more. But how would she make that happen? The camera setup went quickly. Both of the churchmen watched with interest, since neither had seen this happen before. 10 minutes later, both were disappointed with the questions. Both had seen Wise on television, and both had expected better of him. They didn't realize that the story he really wanted was a few miles and an hour or so away. "Good," Wise said, when the vanilla questions were asked and answered. "Can we follow you over to your friend's place?"
"Certainly," His Eminence replied, standing.
He excused himself, because even cardinals have to visit the bathroom before motoring off. At least they did at Demilo's age. But he reappeared and joined Franz for the walk to the car, which the Monsignor would drive, to the continuing disappointment of their own servant-slash-driver, who was, as they suspected, a stringer for the Ministry of State Security. The CNN van followed, twisting through the streets until they arrived at the modest house of the Reverend Yufa An. Parking was easy enough. The two Catholic churchmen walked to Yu's door, carrying a large package, Wise noted.
"Ah," Yu observed with a surprised smile on opening the door. "What brings you over?"
"My friend, we have a gift for you," His Eminence replied, holding up the package.
It was clearly a large Bible, but no less pleasing for the obvious nature of the gift. Yu waved them in, then saw the Americans.
"They asked if they could join us," Monsignor Shepka explained.
"Certainly,"
Yu said at once, wondering if maybe Jerry Patterson might see the story, and even his distant friend Hosiah Jackson. But they didn't get the cameras set up before he unwrapped the package. Yu did this at his desk, and on seeing it he looked up in considerable surprise.